The following program, Democracy on the Brink, The Perils of Excessive Secrecy, was sponsored by the Madison Institute and held in Madison, Wisconsin on November 3, 2007. The speaker is investigative journalist Ted Gupp. Recent books of his include The Wall of Honor, The Secret Lives and Deaths of CIA Operatives, and Nation of Secrets, The Threat to Democracy and the American Way of Life. Ted Gupp.
I want to say how much I appreciate the invitation and how happy I am to come back to Madison. Madison's a wonderful place, and I guess you know it, but it's really a pleasure to be back here. I had dinner last night with some of your board members, and I think it reminded me one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to the city. The material that I dwell in is not always uplifting. It can be pretty depressing. And evenings like last night remind me both why it's worth it and why there's hope. You know, one of the things that I do, I give talks around the country because I care about the subject. One of the talks I gave, which meant the most to me, was in a little church in Biddeford Pool, Maine, called the Union Church. It's a Civil War era church. It's right on the shores of the Atlantic. And after my talk, there was a kind of spontaneous town meeting in this church, a couple hundred people, interdenominational, right and left, conservative and liberal, just speaking about their concerns. And I was so moved by it that I reversed the usual protocol. And at the end of my remarks, I asked everyone in the congregation to sign my book, which is the flip of what usually happens. And I have that book on my shelf. It's cherished because it's a kind of testament to democracy at work and the fact that it can and does work. Yesterday morning, I was awakened at 6 o'clock. The alarm went off. You know, some people ask me, well, don't you get tired of giving the same talk over and over again? The answer is no. I don't give the same talk over and over again because the president continually provides me with fresh material. And yesterday morning was a case in point. The alarm went off at 6 o'clock. It was NPR. And the correspondent was talking about how the president was chastising Congress for its treatment of Michael Mukasey, the nominee for Attorney General. And the president was saying how entirely unfair it is, this line of questioning, because Mukasey did not have clearance, had not been read into the classified portions related to waterboarding. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? How much do you need to know about being flipped upside down, strapped to a board, having a cloth over your head, and someone pouring buckets of water over your face? What additional information do you need to know whether it constitutes torture or not? And then there was kind of the added irony that the president was indignant about this person being subjected to that kind of questioning while defending interrogations that basically create a drowning situation. There's an awfully deep irony there. But anyhow, so I'm grateful to the president for providing that bit of fresh information for my remarks. But that morning, yesterday, like so many, I awaken and I feel a bit like a character in a novel by Kafka called Metamorphosis, or Lewis Carroll, a character named Alice. I awaken, except that I'm not changed. The whole world around me has changed. And it gets harder and harder for me to relate to it. I find myself awakening to an alien environment. And it really is Kafkaesque. I need to say, you know, it's funny, when I do interviews, when I go places, if I'm doing an interview at the CIA or Fort Bragg or a place like that, I will usually remove my earring because I don't want it to get in the way. I don't want it to be a distraction. But my wife rightly said, you're going to Madison, you don't need to do that. But I do want to say that you don't want to read too much into this because I actually believe in a strong defense. I actually believe there should be a central intelligence agency, or at least some entity that collects intelligence. I believe in defense. I'm basically nonpartisan. I have lots of passions, and I'm not afraid to speak my mind, but I'm not a partisan person, and frankly, I think that the travails that we experience today are not the product exclusively of the Republicans, that it's more the product of power. And I've seen this behavior from both parties. And without the collusion or complicity of both parties, I don't think we'd have what we have. So if you're waiting for a red meat partisan speech, this probably isn't it. But I'm not attacking secrecy. I'm attacking obsessive, irrational, excessive secrecy, which threatens the real secrets. There are secrets that need to be protected. I'm talking about troop movements, advanced battle plans. I'm talking about weapons designs. I'm talking about things that anyone would agree on you don't disclose, the identity of our covert operatives overseas. Did I say anyone? Valerie Plame may take issue with that statement. And that's an example of how the profusion of illegitimate secrets has undermined respect for legitimate secrecy and threatens real secrets. And that's going to be one of the themes that you'll hear from me today. In some ways, this is going to be a conservative speech, because I'm going to basically defend secrets by attacking the bogus secrets. Just for a bit of context, it's interesting in terms of religion, history, culture, what we have to say about secrets and the notion of forbidden knowledge, because it goes way back, way back. And I'll just give you a few examples. The Garden of Eden. That goes pretty far back. The apple, the forbidden fruit, the knowledge of good and evil, and a pretty stiff penalty, you got to admit. Mortality, that's a pretty stiff penalty for the knowledge of good and evil. The opening of Pandora's box, the unleashing of all the demons, the knowledge of fire given by Prometheus. He paid a stiff price. I think it was an eagle picked at his liver. Can't be fun. What does that tell us about excessive knowledge? The expressions, ignorance is bliss. What you don't know can't hurt you. Curiosity killed the cat. Right? So there's a kind of stigma attached to wanting to know too much, historically. We see it even in common rules of courtesy. If I were to go out in the audience now and whisper in someone's ear, the rest of you would be offended, because I would have violated common courtesy by whispering. It's rude to whisper. And why is it rude to whisper? It's rude because you marginalize everyone else. The paranoid among you will think it's about you, and even those of you that aren't paranoid will rightly conclude that you've been left out, which is exactly the political dynamic which is sought by excessive secrecy. There's also a rule of courtesy, which is, if someone is whispering around you, you're not supposed to crane your neck and eavesdrop. That's rude, too. And that sets up a kind of contradictory dynamic. It's rude to whisper, but it's rude to try to overhear what's being whispered. And that same dynamic plays out at the national level. It's hard to reconcile them. We recognize that sometimes we need transmissions which are privileged, which are confidential. But it has to be the right setting, and it has to be the right substance. Now, I want to go back to this notion of what you don't know can't hurt you. I want to just offer some snippets from the headlines, which will challenge that notion of what you don't know can't hurt you. Firestone Tires, Ford Explorers, OxyContin, Enron, WorldCom, Vioxx, Virginia Tech, the Catholic Church's role in covering up pedophilia. I could go on and on. These are diverse stories. They appear to be unrelated, but they share a common taproot, and that is secrecy. Excessive secrecy that either created the situation or dramatically exacerbated it. It's amazing how many headlines are joined by the obsession for secrecy. So individuals can get hurt, even killed, and at the national level, secrecy imperils the entire process. It marginalizes members of Congress, the press, the courts, historians, consumers, all denied access to information, and information is the mother's milk of democracy. If you don't have information in a democracy, every choice you make is a crapshoot, a stab in the dark. It seems odd to be having this conversation when transparency is a popular buzzword and we hail this era as the information age. Seems like there must be a disconnect there. How can this be an era of secrecy in the midst of an age of information? And I'm going to try to make this point. In the intelligence community, they differentiate between facts and intelligence. Now, a fact is just that. It's a word we all know. A fact is a bit of information. And God knows the information age is rich in facts. But intelligence is a fact from which can be extrapolated intentionality, motive, design. Facts that rise to the level of intelligence are facts upon which we can act. They help us make choices. The information age is very rich in facts, but not so rich on the information that rises to the level that it can help us make choices in a democracy, oftentimes, in large measure because of secrecy. Now, we can disagree on what constitutes a legitimate secret, but there's no disagreement that there's been an explosion in the number of secrets. A huge explosion. It's more than doubled in the last 10 years. I'll try to give you some numbers here, and numbers can be, as you know, very deceiving. Numbers contain the word num in it, and it's very easy to manipulate them, so I'm going to try, in the interest of full disclosure, to be upfront with you about these numbers. But each year in recent years, the government has brought down the stamp of classification each year about 14 million times. So that works out to 38,000 classification decisions a day, or 1,600 every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It would be great if we had that many good secrets, but we don't. And none of those can tell us where bin Laden is hiding or where he's going to strike next or a host of other things that are extremely important to us. 80% of those secrets were stamped secret or top secret. Now, I want, this is the full disclosure part, a part of the reason for the explosion is that in the old days, if someone wanted to have a conversation, they'd pick up a secure telephone unit, a STU, and they'd talk. And when they were done, they'd hang up, and that would be it. Today, they use the military counterpart of the internet, and that generates an email, and that has to be classified. So what used to be a conversational exchange is now reduced to an email which requires classification. That's accounted for a portion of the explosion, but a small portion only. The cumulative effect, however, is that increasingly we speak not in terms of the right to know, but the need to know. The standard that's used in the military and in intelligence has become the standard of the citizens. There's been a kind of paradigm shift of expectation. We feel now that we have to justify our access to information. We have to explain it. It's not assumed. And there's a cost to this, that not just the abstract cost, but a physical cost. What would it cost to maintain these secrets? Well, you need the safe, the vault. You need the shredder. You need the burn bags. You need the chemical dissolutions. You need the people to manage these secrets. You need the clearances so that the people can handle the secrets. You need the background checks that lead to the clearances. And when you add all this up, the organization that tracks it in the federal government, ISU, the Information Security Oversight Office, the annual estimate of expenditures on secrecy is $7 billion. Now, to put that in perspective, that's the entire budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. If you're not getting depressed, stick around. To deal with these secrets, you need a huge bureaucracy because there are just too many secrets for the hands on deck now to deal with. So you got to hire more people, and you got to elevate the clearance levels. So there are people lined up out the door waiting for clearances so that they can manage the system. Right now, the line out the door would stretch from the Pentagon to Richmond, Virginia, 100 miles. because it's 325,000 people, and the average wait in that line is going to be 1 year or more. Okay? Now, who grants these clearances? OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, which is part of the federal government. In its infinite wisdom, the administration and Congress decided that OPM, with regard to security clearances, would no longer accept money from Congress to pay for it. That it would be a pay-as-you-go plan. That is, if you're the Defense Department and you have someone that needs a clearance, you reach in your wallet, you pull out a check, and you write out a check for $3,000 so that you can get a background check and clearance for this individual. That's about what it is, $3,000. It gets more expensive the higher the security clearance because the greater the background check that's required. So this is a novel system. What happened last year was the Defense Department, the budget for this went dry. They ran out of money for security clearances. So OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, said, no money, no clearances. And they explained it to me in a very colorful way. They said, if you go to a convenience store to get a quart of milk and you don't have any money, you don't get any milk. No money, no milk. Which makes sense in the context of a convenience store, but less so in the context of national security. There's a danger in this culture of secrecy. Now, I have to tell you, I've spent a lot of time with people in the realm of intelligence, the families, the people out in the front line, et cetera, and in the military. And I have a lot of respect for most of the people I've met over the years, a lot of respect. They're not demons. They're not ideologues. I have a lot of respect for them, the risks they take, their commitment. I often find that whatever nobility they represent out in the field is often exploited to lesser advantage and purpose back home at Langley or in Washington at the Pentagon. But there is an innate danger in having this massive culture of secrecy. We are now in the third generation, in some cases, at the CIA. It's a professionalized group. You know, in 47, when they started, you had haberdashers, you had lawyers, you had all kinds of folks in those ranks. They'd gotten their feet wet in the Second World War, but they were essentially rooted in our cultures and values, the General Society of America. But today, the culture of secrecy is much more isolated. And like any genetic population that's isolated, it becomes differentiated from the general population. Not in terms of language or looks, but in terms of mores and ethics. And the folks in this culture of secrecy today, they don't necessarily operate on the same ethical standards that you and I do. Instead of ethics, they sometimes operate on expediency. And the reason is this. That they see the world oftentimes today in Manichaean terms, that is, a struggle between darkness and light, between the Visigoths and civilization. That's how they see it. And if you see the world that way, civilization fighting for its existence, you can dispense pretty quickly with ethics and adopt expediency. And that is, I think, a major explanation for things like rendition and waterboarding, the suspension of habeas corpus at Guantanamo, and a whole lot of other things. If you see the world as a struggle between light and dark, then virtually anything is justified to preserve the light. Now, I've been talking about formal secrecy, but that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's a whole other group of secrets. And they're called sensitive but unclassified, or SBUs. Now, to get something classified, formally classified, secret or top secret, you need what's called original classification authority. And there are only about 4,000 people in the government that possess the right to stamp things original classification authority. There are many more that have the right to stamp something derivative classification authority, which means that if someone includes something already secret in a memo or whatever, that has to be classified as well. That becomes derivative classification. But then there's this whole other group called sensitive but unclassified. And no one knows how many people have that right. millions, not thousands, but millions of government workers and contractors working for the government write on the top of documents, when they feel like it, internal use only, official use only, restricted. And that is a major growth industry in secrecy. Now, you can say, yes, you can get a Freedom of Information Act to request it, but if you don't know it exists, it's hard to request. I was having a conversation with someone earlier, and we were talking about, you know, what a democracy means. Well, for me, reasonable minds can differ about conclusions and outcomes. I might not agree with our leaders, but what's important to me is less whether I agree than whether I can examine how they got to that decision and see whether it represents integrity, honesty, pure motive. That matters to me as much as the outcome. This profusion of sensitive but unclassified documents, together with the formally classified materials, essentially casts a veil, a curtain, over our ability to reconstruct the pathways of decision making so that we can know the end results, but we can't know how they got there. And that's another part of the information age. We can tap in instantly into outcomes and decisions. But the stuff that really matters is how they got to those decisions and outcomes. And the information age isn't so strong on that yet. Now, I want to just tell you a couple of stories to try to put some flesh on the bones here. There's a difference, even post 9/11, between vigilance and hysteria. There's a guy that I met in the archives a couple years ago named John Steinbeis. He was a career guy in the Air Force, and then he joined the Energy Department. And his job was to go through the U.S. archives, along with scores of other people, to go through the old records, at least 25, 30 years old, hundreds of thousands of pages, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages, looking for anything that could help bin Laden or terrorists. And he had a dirty word list. The dirty words would be like nuclear, explosion, terrorist, could be blueprints. So he went through day after day looking. And on 9/10/2001, September 10th, 2001, that's an interesting day, you may recall, right? September 10. He was going through a box of materials, and he often got distracted by what he read because he's reading history, and it's fascinating. So in this box, he opened it up, and he found himself reading about the crash of an American bomber in 1945 into the Empire State Building, in which 14 people were killed, and the whole city of New York was traumatized. And he spent some time reading it. It was fascinating. But nowhere in the files was there anything related to the dirty word list. And so he packed it up and put it back on the shelf. And the next day he was in the cafeteria and at archives, and the television was interrupted by the attack on the towers. And he realized that the day before he'd looked into the very face of the threat and hadn't recognized it because it wasn't on his dirty word list. And it was a very vivid illustration about the limits of vigilance and the limits of our imagination. I want to tell you a story about Judith Polya. How many of you know that name? Any of you know that? Okay. There's a case called U.S. v. Reynolds. And some of you are lawyers out there, and I'll bet I'll be corrected on something if I step off here, and I would welcome it, honestly. I'm a lawyer by training, but so long ago that I can't really, I'm at that awkward stage where I can't claim that I'm clean and pure because it's been so many years, and I can't claim to know anything because it's been so many years. This is the bellwether case in state secrets. When they toss a case these days, when someone sues the government for torture, rendition, whatever it is, the case that they rely on is U.S. v. Reynolds. So it's worth knowing a little bit about Reynolds and this case, okay? So what happened was, on October 6, 1948, a B-29 over Georgia crashed, fell out of the sky, and on board were a lot of civilian engineers. And the widows got together and sued the federal government. Basically a tort. They sued the federal government for the loss of their loved ones. And the federal government said, this can't proceed, because if it does, we're going to compromise national security. The things about the flight that, if they emerge, are going to compromise national security. So the case didn't proceed. They lost. Well, at that time, Judith Paglia was 7 weeks old. She was the daughter of one of the widows. She didn't know anything. She has no memories of her father, obviously. But a few years back, she was surfing the web at home. And she stumbled across the fact that the report on this crash had been declassified. And I talked with her about this. She said she was dumbstruck that she hadn't known this. And so she got the report and read it. And her reaction was one of horror, because there was nothing, the report said, classified about the flight, contrary to what the government had claimed. Nothing classified. But what really tore her apart was what the report contained, which was information that the plane had been shoddily maintained, suggesting that had been the reason it crashed, which raised a whole new issue about why the report had been withheld and why secrecy had been invoked. So she brought an action, a kind of second-generation action. And the Solicitor General, Ted Olson, who engaged her on this issue, and the government, took a novel argument here. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the argument, as I read it, and the people I interviewed, the argument was, we didn't say it was classified or secret. We said it could have been. And that won the day. And her case did not proceed. And that case is on such shaky ground, but it is the case upon which all of these secrecy cases are now being tossed. And if you look at the number of times it's cited, it's grown exponentially in the last 4 or 5 years. It was almost never cited before, but now it's routinely cited in these secrecy cases. Now, I want to tell you the story of Jose. This is one of my favorites. Pardon me for 1 second. I'm going to try not to spill this. I went to Washington a couple of years ago. Harvard had organized a luncheon for about a dozen folks like myself that write about intelligence matters. And it was just an informal luncheon. There were a couple of people there from the agency, from the CIA, but there were, I think, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 reporters, New York Times, Washington Post, a bunch of different people, authors. And this name, Jose, kept coming up. And I'd heard Jose before. You know, if you just kind of sat in at this table, you'd think, well, this guy must be like a fraternity brother or something, because everybody knows him so well, he's on a first-name basis. But the fact is that almost no one at that meeting had ever met Jose. And the reason that they didn't use his last name is because it's against the law, because he's covert. And it's an interesting case because he's not out in the jungles of El Salvador. He's not undercover in Afghanistan. He's not in Beirut. He's in Washington in a very cushy office. He's a bureaucrat. And he oversees thousands of American undercover operatives. He's in charge of the National Clandestine Service. That's what he does. So why would he be covert? What advantage would that serve? Well, if he's covert, it means you can't write his last name. It means that if he's called to testify on the Hill, it has to be behind a curtain with his voice disguised. It means that he can't be questioned directly, that he can't be held directly accountable. So it serves a great purpose for the agency. So I called the agency when I was concluding my book, and I said, you know, I'm thinking of using Jose's last name. What do you think? And they said, if you do, we will refer you to the Department of Justice for prosecution, because you will be revealing the identity of a covert operative, which is, in fact, against the law, notwithstanding Rove and Libby. So I didn't include the name in the book. I left it out. I wrote a kind of sporty, fun piece about it. But you know what's not so funny is that if you wanted to find out Jose's last name, you could look it up in Wikipedia. You could look it up in the foreign press of many countries. About the only people that don't know his last name are the Americans. And that just didn't seem quite right. A few weeks after my book came out, they lifted the cover, and so he is now overt. But it's a little case study in the absurdities of secrecy. Here's a couple more. The oldest records in the archives that are classified date back to 1917. And when the Kaiser was in power, and they date back to World War I, and they're the German secret formula for invisible ink. And when people tried to have that declassified in recent years, the agency said you can't declassify it because it'll compromise our ability to communicate. Now, you got to admit, in the internet age, if that's true, we are in a lot of trouble. Invisible ink formulas from 1917. Now, fast forward. In 1991, an Iraqi came forward. He had buried some documents under a rose bush that were essentially blueprints and documents related to the centrifuge, which is a key component of making an atomic weapon. And he came forward during this current Gulf War, gave them to the United States government. The U.S. government, as you know, was adamant about Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction. And they were positively gleeful to get these documents, even though they related to 1991, not the present. And they related to Saddam Hussein's attempts to reconstitute a nuclear weapons program. 1991, not now, but the administration was gleeful to have them. So gleeful that the CIA put the documents on its website for all to see. And people around the world started downloading them, including in Pakistan. Weapons scientists at Los Alamos contacted the CIA and said, "What are you smoking? What are you thinking?" And it remained up for a couple of weeks, and finally they took it down. And when asked why, they said it had been up there long enough, which I think is understatement beyond comprehension. There is an expression that George Bundy, a former national security advisor, said, which I quote often because I love it. He said, "If you guard your toothbrushes and your diamonds with equal zeal, you'll lose fewer toothbrushes, but more diamonds." And that invisible ink is a toothbrush. Those centrifuge blueprints, those are diamonds. So I want to take you for a few minutes into the mindset of this culture of secrecy so that you can understand something about why things are the way they are. If you are, and the first time that I was really formally introduced to this was after my book on the CIA came out. In 2000, I got a letter from someone in the agency who did classification there. And he said, "You have to understand, when you're in government and you have a stack of documents on your desk, you got to prioritize them. You got to figure out what's going to get your attention first. So if it's unclassified, it goes right to the bottom. If it's classified confidential, it goes on top of that stuff. If it's classified secret, it goes on top of the confidential. If it's classified top secret, it goes on top of the secret. If it's classified sensitive compartmented information code word only, it goes on top of the whole bit." Okay? Now, what kind of message does that send to a bureaucracy? Because no one has ever been taken to the woodshed for overclassification, ever. You can be taken to the woodshed for failing to classify, but not for overclassifying. And every bureaucrat knows this. So if you want your materials to be read, you classify them, and you classify them as high as you can for multiple reasons. Not only does it confer interest on the document, it confers power and authority on the author of the document. You become a player. You're invited into the inner circle. And if you don't have access to that level of classification, you're marginalized. You're excluded. This is a very old game, but it's now become heavily institutionalized. If you work in a system in which hoarding of information leads to advancement personally or as an entity, as an agency or a department, you get the message. And the message is, although perhaps not intended, that sharing information constitutes a dilution of power and authority, which runs directly contrary to the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission, the bipartisan commission, which found that America did not lack sufficient information to thwart the 9/11 attack. What it lacked was sufficient sharing of the information it possessed, which in terms of intelligence is called a lack of connectivity. So the question, the central question in this area becomes, how do you get a culture of secrecy that's deeply embedded and rooted to change the way it operates, the values it holds, so that it looks beyond its own advancement to the well-being of us all as a country? And there's been a lot of rhetoric about creating an environment of sharing, you know, plays well with others. It sounds like daycare. But bureaucracies don't respond to rhetoric. They respond to behavior they see that is rewarded by superiors, like all bureaucracies. And one need look no further than Rumsfeld, or Cheney, or Bush to see classic stovepiping and manipulation and cherry-picking of intelligence, not sharing. Rumsfeld had his own operation, intelligence operation, in the Pentagon, which selectively excluded information that was disconfirming data for the proposition that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. People in the Pentagon saw this. People at the CIA saw this. There's 16 entities or units within the intelligence community. I say community in quotes because it's sometimes not much of a community. Defense Intelligence Agency, CIA, there's overhead satellite stuff. There's each of the service branches has intelligence capacities. So there's 16 entities. You got to get them on the same page or else we're vulnerable. So this is part of the culture of secrecy. Now, there's a notion that secrets are truer, more credible than things that are not secret. If you see a Brinks truck on the road, you reach a certain conclusion. Whatever's in there has got to be precious cargo. It's got to be valuable because it's worth protecting. Well, that's true, but there's another reason why things are protected. You remember the boy in the bubble whose immunosystem was compromised? He was protected, wasn't he? And why was he protected? He was protected because his immune system was not capable of fending off germs. And it's the same with information. Oftentimes, it's protected by secrecy because it can't withstand the scrutiny of light. Oftentimes, information is classified because it can't withstand the push, pull, and tug of open debate and discourse. So, in fact, some information which is secret or classified is less credible, not more credible, which runs completely contrary to the sort of cachet that attaches to secrecy. There was a very disturbing report. I first read it in the Boston Globe. I did not break this story, but it certainly stuck with me, and I know many of you know this. But people that deal in this stuff, they know that a lot of these secrets are vapid or untrue, and it creates a kind of culture of disdain. They just don't put much stock in the secrets anymore. And one of the telling factors is that before we went to war with Iraq, I think that the number in the Senate, you know, if you're going to read the classified portions of the National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, which is the summary, the best guess of the U.S. intelligence community, members of the U.S. Senate can read those classified sections so that they're informed when they vote. Well, to do that, you have to go into this special room and you have to sign in because they keep a close custodial watch on these documents. Do you know that before they voted to go to war, 96 out of 100 senators didn't go in and read it? And we know that because we have the names of the people that went in. And this is the same with virtually all matters related to classification. They don't go in to read it. And they don't go in to read it for two reasons, which are very interesting. One is they suspect it's hogwash and it's not going to enhance their understanding. Or two, if they go in and read it, they feel like they're going to be encumbered in their ability to talk about it because once read into classified materials, someone can say you can't talk about that because that's not unclassified. And so they're kind of stuck. And as our representatives, we're kind of stuck. So let's take up for a minute, and I'm in the home stretch here, so don't despair. Let's take up for a minute why it is that there's so much secrecy now. Because, and you may not agree with this, but From my reading of history, secrecy attaches not to Republicans but to power. Virtually anybody in power prefers not to be held accountable. They don't like their toes held to the fire. LBJ, in 1966, when he signed the Freedom of Information Act, Bill Moyers recalls how he basically held his nose in signing. He didn't want to sign the Freedom of Information Act. If you want to find a politician that supports transparency truly, you got to find a politician who has either been defeated or retired. Because anybody in power does not champion transparency, basically. Not when it comes to themselves. Always the opposition, yes. You know, when they're out, you got to have transparency. Why, if that's the impulse, if the impulse of power is to embrace secrecy always and always has been, then why so much secrecy now? Well, for that you have to go, I have a little button that says history is everything. And that is, I guess, the answer. Because if you go back to the mid-70s, you'll remember a little thing called Watergate and the reforms that came out of Watergate. They kind of tightened the belt on the executive. They reduced the power and authority and latitude of the president. They gave more power to the Congress in terms of oversight. They also had hearings into the CIA, the Pike and Church hearings, which exposed an awful lot of hair-curling misdeeds. Everything from coups, assassinations, I mean, just incredible stuff. And so the CIA had its feathers clipped as well in the mid-70s. And that's a clipping of the executive branch, because the CIA works for the president. Contrary to what you've heard, the CIA is not a rogue organization. It works for the president. Whatever they do is done by directive, executive order. They're not out there as renegades. They're out there, for the president to say the CIA did it, it wasn't me, it's like saying it was my fingers pulled the trigger, it wasn't me. I mean, they're all attached. You know, it's the same arm. So when they cut back on the authority of the CIA, they cut back on the presidency. Well, there were a couple of fellas that didn't think that was a good idea in the mid-70s. They thought the president should be very powerful. They resented this curtailment of power. And they were brilliant, and they were patient, and they were plotting with a D and a T. And two that come to mind from the mid-70s were Cheney and Rumsfeld. They were very patient, and they became the architects to a significant degree of the expansion of executive power that we now see in the Bush administration under a doctrine called unitary executive. And unitary executive is a kind of forbidding term, but it just means unitary is one. An executive doesn't need any amplification. It just means there's only one executive. And that person, the president, should have sole say in the conduct of war, should have much greater latitude in the conduct of policy, and shouldn't be told what to do with regard to all the agencies and departments underneath him or her. Okay? The unitary executive helps explain why we have so much secrecy. Why? Because if you want to expand the presidency and its powers, it means this is kind of like a pie, you know, and it's like a pie chart. The pie doesn't grow in size. If you serve someone a larger slice, you serve someone else a smaller slice. That being Congress, that being the courts. And folks don't like to give up that extra slice of pie, you know? So how do you disable them? How do you neuter them? You starve them of information. Because if opposition doesn't have information, they can't challenge what's being done. There's no quicker way to marginalize the opponents than to cut off their oxygen, which is basically information. It works with the public, it works with the press, it works with the Congress. And that's one of the central reasons, I believe, why we see so much secrecy. Now, there are other reasons, and I'm just going to race through these because then I want to conclude. Historically, there have been checks, breaks on the expansion of secrecy, and we all know what they are. So let's tick off a few and see why they didn't work this time. One of them is Congress. Congress has always been a break on excessive secrecy. Not always. McCarthy era, no. During the Red Scare, 1919, 1920, Palmer raids, no. Civil War, habeas corpus suspended. There have been cycles. But historically, Congress has been a break on it. So why not now? Well, for one, we had one party in power in both houses and the White House, the Republicans. So there was no opposition in a position of authority, which in my mind is unhealthy. And I'll be honest, I know this is, I'm going to duck when I say this so I don't get hit by any tomatoes, but I'd be more comfortable if there was a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate or House, and a Republican controlling one of the houses. That is, I believe in a mixture of power. I think we're always better off. No tomatoes. Good, thank you. But Congress, because it was under one party, party loyalties trumped national loyalties. There were fewer and fewer hearings. The hearings that were held behind closed doors. They didn't insist upon subpoenas and sworn testimony. They took this mamby-pamby kind of informal stuff behind closed doors, ridiculous, on critical matters. The Democrats, the so-called loyal opposition, were more loyal than opposition. They basically ceded the field. They were AWOL for years and years. That's why I regard them as complicit in this, because they just went along. And it was incredible. You know, the General Accounting Office, which is the investigative arm, it's not no longer the General Accounting Office, now the Government Accountability Office. They changed the name, but it's still GAO. The GAO is the investigative arm of Congress. Do you know that the intelligence community, the Pentagon, and the president have basically told the GAO, you have no authority to even ask questions related to intelligence? I mean, that's the quickest way in the world to disable congressional hearings. So, you don't have Congress to put a brake on secrecy. What about the press? Well, in the months and years following 9/11, they were scared to death to appear to be unpatriotic. So they pulled their punches. And they did the country a disservice in so doing. And at the very same time, when all of these things are happening out of the White House, journalism is undergoing profound economic dislocations, layoffs, buyouts, cutbacks, reduction in investigative reporting, celebrity reporting, localization, more and more parochial reporting, closing of foreign bureaus around the world, which might have picked up some of these abuses. So the press was largely neutered as well. The Freedom of Information Act was kneecapped by John Ashcroft, Attorney General, in his early days. He reversed the presumption of openness and basically green-lighted, said to all the agencies and departments of government, if you can think of a reason why we don't have to turn over materials, I'll support you. It was really kind of, it should have been called the straight face test. If you can come up with something past the straight face test, I'll go with it. All right. And then there was something else which accounts for this expansion. It's 9/11, but not in the way you might think. People were afraid, and as you know, citizens are one of the great breaks on expansion of secrecy, but I think a lot of Americans just said, keep us safe and don't tell us how. I mean, one of the things that I fear or disturbs me the most is not what Americans are not allowed to know, but what Americans don't want to know. That is, I think that a lot of people embrace secrecy to numb conscience. That is, they don't want to know because they don't want to be encumbered by the knowledge. We love the 90 miles that separate Miami from Guantanamo. You know, it's as if ethics has a kind of extraterritoriality to it. You know, if it's beyond our reach, we're not responsible, even though everything that we do is that is done is at our command. Same with rendition. If someone pulls someone's fingernails out in Cairo at our behest, but we're not doing the pulling, but we get the information, somehow we can distance ourselves from that. And that notion about being safe seems to be paramount. But there's another way that 9/11 has affected all this. And that is that when 9/11 happened, the notion of what constituted national security changed dramatically. After 9/11, everything was a target. The entire American infrastructure. Bridges, railways, airports, ports, storage facilities, Superfund sites, electrical grids, high-rises, chemical plants, food supplies, water supplies, dams. We could spend the rest of the morning listing everything in America that's a potential target. What are the implications of that? Virtually every entity, private and public, industry, government, at the city, state, and federal level, suddenly became a part of the national security apparatus, dragooned into the classification and secrecy authority. Websites came down, blueprints disappeared, questions went unanswered. So national security no longer was the unique preserve of the CIA or the Pentagon. It was ubiquitous. And then finally, the information age, the wonderful information age. The information age, ironically, in some ways, has given rise to the security age. Because the information age, computers and the internet, they do two principal things. Now, this is gross oversimplification, but I think you'll agree with me on this. One is, it creates a massive aggregation of information. And the second is that it creates the possibility to transmit spontaneously and universally that massive aggregation of information, both of which are nightmare scenarios for people to keep secrets, because it means that the whole body of secrets can be taken out. You know, in the old days, in the Pentagon Papers days, literally, in the Pentagon Papers case and other cases like it, people had to walk out with stuff under their arms and make multiple trips. Now they can put everything on a CD or just hit the send button. And it doesn't just go to one person or the New York Times. It goes literally around the world in an instant. And that fear has given rise to a robust security industry to control and contain secrets. And in fact, the internet and computers and software have even aided and abetted in keeping those secrets. I'll give you two examples, and then I'm going to wind up. One is, at the Pentagon, they have their own, like, internet. We talked about that before. But in the old days, if you had a paragraph that needed classification, you would classify that paragraph discreetly. But these days, the software system is such that when you put in your headers and footers, you can hit one button and the whole thing is classified. So instead of it being a discrete classification, it's a blanket classification, so you don't even know what subject the document relates to. I'll give you another example. This is the federal courts, and half my book is related, not related to federal government, it's related to how secrecy intersects with our lives. But this is a kind of hybrid. It goes both to government and to our general lives, and that is the federal courts. As you know, the paradigm, the myth is that in courts, things go to a jury of our peers. It's decided openly. It sets a precedent. We all know what it is, and it's a nice, open, transparent system. That's a myth. In the federal system now, the number of cases that go to a jury, that are openly adjudicated, go to a jury, has fallen below 2%. It's now 1.3%. Instead, it's now alternative dispute resolution. That's the key word. Trials are regarded by judges as a kind of pathology, something to be avoided. There's actually, the ABA and others have actually had conferences talking about the phenomenon of the disappearing trial. Okay? There are judges and lawyers that have little experience conducting full trials now. I mean, it's unbelievable. There's a lot of literature out there about it. But supposing that you find out one of these cases that has been settled and sealed, and you want to read about it and find out what happened. Well, the federal court system, the uniform federal court system of this country, the bankruptcy courts and federal courts, they have a software program that was developed centrally. And it is the gateway to 26 million cases. And you can plug in the case style, the name of the case, Jones v. U.S. or Jones v. Ford, whatever it is. You can plug that in, this case that was settled and sealed. But the way the software was programmed, the default response is no such case exists. And that's just a bald lie. Case exists, you just aren't allowed to know about it. And the reason they adopted that format, and it's written out in memos I have, is that it says they were afraid that the press would make inquiries or that other litigators would make hay out of this information. And so they came up with this concoction, no such case exists. That's an example of how software actually aids and abets the keeping of secrecy. I had a judge I was asking about a particular case involving Graco, which is a manufacturer of children's stuff. And I saw a case, I learned about a case that was sealed involving a little girl named Destiny who was allegedly injured by a product Graco made. And I did some investigative reporting, and to be honest, and I spent a lot of time on it, I couldn't find out if she was paralyzed or skinned her knee. I couldn't find out what product it was. It's all sealed. And I talked to the attorney that represented the family, and he wouldn't talk to me because his lips were sealed by the agreement. And I asked the attorney that represented Graco, and he wouldn't talk to me because it was sealed. And then I went to the judge, and I said, could we have a conversation about this? And his clerk got back to me and said, yes, if you'll sign this agreement to keep it a secret. So I never did find out what the product was. What I did find out was that millions of Graco products in the years after have been recalled, that there have been, I don't know, half a dozen deaths and scores of injuries related to multiple products, and that Graco was hit with the largest single penalty from the Consumer Product Safety Commission for failing to report in a timely fashion these problems. But that little girl, Destiny, isn't counted among the numbers because no one, neither of the attorneys, reported it to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It just disappeared. So that notion that what you don't know can't hurt you, I don't buy it. Okay. I'm going to conclude now, and it's this is a nice Saturday morning, and you all are out here, and you're the reason I'm here, and you're the reason why I don't slip my wrists over this stuff, because there are a lot of folks out there that care, conservatives and liberals, right and left, Republicans and Democrats. Much of the information in my books comes from people. Who are either nonpartisan or within the institutions and departments of which I write. I've interviewed three-star generals and grunts. I've interviewed you name it. But they all care. I got an email the other day. The Arts and Entertainment Channel ran a program about a story that I broke years ago about the Greenbrier. It's a resort in West Virginia where Congress was to go in the event of a nuclear war. And I broke this story years and years ago. I held it for 4 months to make sure it wouldn't hurt the government. I mean, hurt, you know, national security. And I'd be happy to discuss why I decided to run it in the Washington Post. But anyhow, this program ran, Arts and Entertainment or History Channel ran a program on it. And the next day I got an email from somebody saying you should be tried for treason. And I occasionally get that. But I get hundreds, and after my books literally thousands of correspondence, email, letters, calls, and whether they're on the right or the left, they're deeply concerned, they're interested, there's little animus, there's just kind of a search, a quest for, you know, what can we do? And I really, I'm not a pessimist, and I'll tell you for two reasons. One, because of the meetings and the faces and the voices that I hear, and second, because I read history. And history has shown that it is cyclical, and we've been in bad spots before. And if you pick any spot in history, you can find incredibly dark chapters in our past that it's just miraculous that we emerged from. The period of eugenics, I mean, that was just a nightmare. You know, involuntary sterilization, deportation. I mean, we've had, notwithstanding the myths of America, we've had some dark chapters, but we've emerged. And I believe in the power of history. I believe in the power of citizens. So I don't believe that we're in any way fated to labor under this kind of regime forever. I just don't believe it. I want to thank you for sticking with us so long. I really appreciate it. And if I've left you in despair, I have to tell you, you've not left me in despair. I appreciate it. And I thank you very much.
The foregoing program was sponsored by the Madison Institute and funded in part by a grant from the EVU Foundation, the charitable arm of the Capital Times. Books by the speaker, Ted Gupp, include The Wall of Honor and Nation of Secrets. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute or of the EVU Foundation.